Yeah.
Okay, well, thank you for coming back this afternoon. I think Garrett might be saying he's probably closer to being a demographer than being a, someone who works on change points. But one of the things we kind of hoped we might get while we were here was some interesting data sets that might have issues for change point analysis. And Guy's very kindly agreed to talk about some of the data that he's worked on, to present some of the ideas of how he's worked on it, but then also to throw out some sort of questions that might be relevant for people working on change points that he, well, he's told me he doesn't know the answers to. So hopefully it will kind of give us some ideas about things that are problems that people with sort of working on application areas might be interested in. So,
okay. Guy, over to you. Thanks, John, and thank you for the invitation to the workshop. And yep, from last week, I found things very useful and gave me some ideas for other demographic data sets that I'm not going to show today, but that other applications of change point models. So I sort of come into this not really knowing too much about change points. Yeah, it's good to learn a bit more about different statistical methods. So I'm based in Vienna at the Wittgenstein Center, which branches across these three institutions. It's part of the Academy of Sciences, it's the business university, and it's very difficult to explain. So we're a big institute that was set up 50 years ago for Soviet and Western scientists to collaborate. So looking at different types of systems, so population and climate and so on. So I'm based there and sort of work a lot on estimating global migration flows, and now I'm starting to look at different time series methods for forecasting population. So the talk today is sort of split in two. So the first half is on this title. Sort of came into this thinking about volatility models for migration. And then the second half is on fertility data and trying to forecast fertility for all countries in the world, which I think is a change point problem. But I mean, the sort of UN have their model that they sort of acknowledge change points, but it's all deterministic rather than having any sort of model to identify the change points. Start with the migration, where I realized I did actually use a change point model without knowing it until I met John at JSM, and then I thought, actually, I think I've used the change point model here. So it's really coming at a volatility angle. What are the motivations for exploring volatility in migration flows? Firstly, that sort of migration is a really important driver of demographic growth in developed countries. So fertility and mortality are stable, so it's very easy to forecast fertility and mortality, or if you get your fertility forecast wrong a little, it doesn't have too big a consequence on the overall population size. If you get your migration forecast wrong by a little percentage, then it can have a large effect on the overall population size. It's a lot harder to forecast the migration than fertility and mortality. So it's a major source of uncertainty in demographic projections. Sort of uncertainty is born out from the past, that there's lots of fluctuations. Migration goes up and down, kind of goes in waves related to economic cycles, perhaps, and political factors as well, and legal factors. So the sort of idea is, well, why didn't we try and use some volatility models and apply them to migration time series? In fact, it's a sort of limited area that usually sort of national statistics institutes, when they forecast populations, they need to set their assumptions on mortality, fertility, and migration. Usually on migration, they, rather than use a stochastic model, they tend to use just some assumption. So for example, in the UK, the Office of National Statistics has a committee of five or six demographic experts. And they will say, well, we think net migration is going to be, you know, to 300,000 for the continuing future for the next 50 years. They don't use any sort of time series methods, so it's all determined. And you kind of get some funny things going on where sort of the level that it's determined perhaps is tweaked towards, so the population ends up lower than sort of what politicians want it to be, or just as the politicians want it to be, rather than more realistic assumption that you might get from a time series model or any kind of model. So the sort of aim is to use time series models to firstly better understand the volatility process, to actually sort of get some graphic with the volatility, past volatility, provide some forecasts with uncertainty. Usually sort of in demography, sort of things are changing, where sort of state of the art up to about 20 years ago was just to get some projection out with a high and a low, where you didn't really know what high and low meant. So now people are starting to switch over to probabilistic forecasts using statistical models. And I'm going to do this for a range of data. I'm going to use net migration, then a net migration series, immigration series, and an emigration series. So three different types of migration and migration measures, and for four Nordic countries. So I chose Nordic countries because I was worried about the data length. So usually sort of demographic times are quite short, or you only have like observations every year. So Nordic countries have a long history of collecting demographic data. So I knew, well, at least I'm going to get over 50 points, 40 points that I could try and fit some time series models to. So why time series models? Well, they have been previously used for modeling migration, usually with some sort of constant variance rather than a change in variance. But they allow you to forecast future values based on the past. So you don't have to rely on some explanatory variable. So sort of the minimum requirement usually for a demographic projection somewhere around like 10 years. Perhaps we have a horizon up to 2100 or something like this. So if I wanted to incorporate some other explanatory variables such as GDP or something, then I wouldn't have any. It's very difficult to get a GDP forecast 10 years ahead, usually only goes 2 or 3 years ahead, let alone 20 or 30 years. So it sort of rules out trying to use explanatory variables. So time series methods are just auto-regressing on its past. I don't have to worry about that. Of course, there's a whole library of methods that I'm still learning about. So there's various extensions to account for volatility. And also sort of kind of another minimum of a projection is to disaggregate your results by age and sex. So you get your population forecast by age and sex. So as an input, you need your fertility and mortality and migration forecast by age and sex. But for migration, it's very, very regular. The sort of migration when you decompose over age. So maybe I can draw it out. That sort of, there's this sort of classic, it's called a Rogers-Castro's curve, where this is your propensity to migrate, and this is your this is age. And then you get some sort of age schedule like this, where sort of peak migration age is around sort of in your 20s, early 20s, and then there's some child migrating with their parents. And as you get older, your propensity to migrate is a lot less. And people have looked at hundreds and hundreds of different migration streams, and this pattern is always there, pretty much. Perhaps some streams you get some little bumps for retirement, but it tends to be fairly constant. So if you can just forecast migration alone, the total number, and you can just decompose by age very, very quickly. Usually sex is only selected streams are, is there a big sex difference? So that's really not a worry with migration. So I took a Bayesian approach because I felt kind of offers a more natural framework than a sort of frequentist approach, that I can explicitly incorporate uncertainty about the parameters in the models into the forecast, so I can have a more realistic projection from a range of models. Also to calculate the posterior distributions from sort of non-constant with non-constant variance terms. So if I want to relax or make an assumption that I don't have a constant variance throughout time, then I found that it was quite relatively easy to do with the sort of in a Bayesian framework. Sort of quite easy. I was using WinBugs throughout, so it's just adding an extra line of code usually to account for non-constant variance. Of course, things like missing data in the predictive distributions sort of follow very easily. It's sort of just in WinBugs, it's just a missing node, so I don't have to do tons of programming to get that out. And also sort of down here, I think this is also sort of, I've actually done a paper like this where we've sort of elicited a bunch of like 30 experts' opinions about future migration. We just did it, immigration into the UK. We sort of got this projection fan of what they thought the future migration would be. And then we turned that into some sort of prior distributions on time series model and parameters. And so this is sort of an area that You know, in demographic projections, we often rely on expert opinions, and I think gradually, myself and some others, we're trying to formally incorporate into a whole Bayesian framework these Bayesian sort of priors from experts, which we rely on a lot, to along with the data from the past time series. I think there's some sort of evidence, some potential to use change point models there, that sort of you have this distribution in the future, and then you have your past data, and perhaps you can use change point models to kind of meddle them together.
Immigration or migration will probably depend on government policy. And so when you have the experts over there, what are you going to sort of run different scenarios with if one policy was this way, one policy was this way, one policy was this way, prior on it, and then see kind of how it's...
Yeah, that's, I'm not going to do it here, but that I've worked on that before. And so you sort of go through this Delphi type question method. So you ask a couple of rounds, you show the experts their results, and sort of say, so you have a questionnaire saying, what do you think the future migration will be in 2030 if they have this policy, for example, or if this policy isn't implemented, what is the counterfactual, and what's the uncertainty with that? And then you can get back and forth, yeah. So then you can try and see what experts think, and the data is telling you as well, combined about future migration under different possible policies. Now onto the data, I guess. So here are the four countries. This is net migration. So this is Denmark, Finland, Norway, and Sweden. And the black line is the net migration throughout time. I think you start about 1750 up to 2010. So this data is not directly available, sort of thing. This is worked out via demographic accounting, that if you know the population at the start of the year and the end of the year, the number of births over the year and the number of deaths over the year, then the remainder is the net migration. So you can work out all these series. So you can see it's quite interesting. So these are basically some bad harvests and some mass emigration out of Finland, say, to the US or other parts of Europe. Same in Norway, back here in the 17th, 18th century.
How was population counted?
Through censuses, and then between censuses, there's some sort of historic estimation done by the National Statistics Offices to get them by year. So they have them every 10 years, basically. But their censuses started along, so I think Sweden was the first country to do a census, but they have a long way back.
And is there any measurement uncertainty associated?
Not given, but there is. And I think that I'll mention that later, that, well, you can see these are the different series, yeah. So I think maybe they're a bit more volatile here because of the measurement uncertainty. So it's another thing to take into account. And the other sort of point to mention is the dotted lines. There, I put them in. That these are just for comparison. These dotted lines, and these are the difference between the immigration and the emigration. There's also net migration, but they're not exactly the same, because in each country they have a different definition of immigration, different definition of emigration. So, for example, in Denmark, they count immigrants as you have to stay in the country for 6 months to be an immigrant. So you might stay for 6 months and go back, and then so you wouldn't be counted or I wouldn't have calculated you in the net migration because you weren't in the population at the end of the year. And they have different definitions. If you're a Finn returning, then as soon as you return, you come into the population register, and you're counted as a migrant. Whereas if you're a non-Finn coming into Finland, you have to stay there 12 months to become a migrant. So it's migration data is very messy, and it's very difficult to compare across countries, or even to compare immigration and emigration data within countries. It's difficult. And pretty much no country in the world has a full demographic account where they have their immigration and emigration plus the births and the deaths to add up to the population.
What's the reason that the Danish data started 1910 or something and the other Nordic countries started?
I'm not sure. I just went to there. National Statistics Office's websites and got the data, and that was as far as they went back. And these other ones, they went back further. I'm not sure why not. Perhaps they're uncertain about their data, or they've not done these sort of inter-census estimates that they're worried about it. On the right-hand side of the different series, so you can see these are fairly stationary in mean, but perhaps not in invariants, so it's definitely less volatile around here. So that sort of motivates the volatility models. So these are the net migration measures. And then for each country, I've also got the immigration and the emigration. So I think the immigration is the dark line, and the emigration is the dotted line. So you see the emigration for Norway is a lot longer series than the immigration. So you can see really, like, it's really quite rising, the immigration into Norway and Sweden. So these are sort of they're waves from recently, from like the Iraq War and the Kurds and former Yugoslavia. And then, again, these are the difference on the log immigration and the difference on the immigration rate. So again, these are the actual series that I'm going to model. So I'm going to show you now a range of the models, sort of my model space. I fit these to each of these three different series. So I use the net migration counts rather than a rate. Usually in demography, we really like rates because they're quite nice and stable over time. You can compare them across countries. But for net migration, that's a big problem because you don't really know what the denominator is for a net migration. It's not really the population in the country. It's also reliant on the population of the rest of the world. So people prefer to use counts. Well, people prefer not to use net migration because if you use net migration in a demographic projection model, then lots of papers showing that it brings in bias and lots of problems that you wouldn't get if you used immigration and emigration if you decompose the net migration. So then I use the net migration count. I use the logarithm of the immigration count to ensure it's positive. Again, you don't really know the rate. The denominator for the immigration count is the rest of the world, the potential pool of people that could come in. So rather than have that, I just model on the count. And then the emigration rate, so I know the population in the country, so I can work out the rate. And I fit some sort of standard P, I'm go from 0 to 8. So these are just autoregressive models. I don't constrict anything to be stationary. So these are my autoregressive parameters, and this is inverse gamma on the variance term. So this has no T subscript. It's constant across time. I fit some stochastic volatility models where I then add this T subscript. And then I say for the volatility process, so the log of the variance is AR1 centered. I have my inverse gamma prior on the sort of average volatility across time. And then I restrict the coefficient to be between -1 and 1 for the for the volatility process. And this is like a hyper prior on the variance of the volatility. And then my change point model is pretty much as I am now calling it is again I've got p going from 0 to 8. So for the mean term, I have a range of models, and the variance is from this McCulloch-Kinsey paper, but adapted a little. For the priors, so they could be more comparable to the previous models. So here the variance is equal to the last year's variance, or it's scaled by beta, or the exponential of beta. So it's either, and this is dependent on this delta t, which is time dependent, and delta t is this sort of 0, 1, with probability of beta 1 in 100 chance of a shift as a prior. So the variance is sort of always set to last year, but then if delta might switch to 1, so it indicates that there's a change in the variance, and then it inflates by beta.
Question. Yep. So this is a conditional distribution, isn't it? So it's YT conditional on the path.
Yep. Yeah.
Because I see this all the way through. Is this a type of J equals 0?
No, this is in the mean process. So that could be 0, so that's 0, so that's 0. So this is all 0. So then is an independent normal with?
No, this I understand, but is J equal 1?
You can have J is 0 there, yeah.
And that's YT's got normal distribution of Y.
0.
What's YT minus J? I just nitpick. I just want to make sure that I'm.
Okay, well, that you could say that was 1, but then I also have another model where it's 0 in here, and this is sigma T. So it's normal 0 sigma t, is one model. Then there's another model that's normal AR1 sigma t. Then AR2 sigma t. I'll show you the next slide, it's maybe easier. These are my range of models. One's an independent normal, one's an AR1, AR2, AR3, up to AR8.
He's defining phi 0 to be equal to 0.
Yeah, essentially, yeah. I need.
Sorry? He's defining phi 0 to be equal to 0.
Yes.
Yeah, without stating it.
Okay, all right.
Okay.
Now that makes more sense.
Yeah, so I ran all those models. So the constant variance models, the stochastic volatility, and the random variance shift models. And then for each of these variance terms and each of these mean structures, and I calculated the normalizing constant using the bridge sampler in R, and then I calculated the posterior model probabilities for each series. So you can see for the net migration, it's sort of pretty much, within each table, they sum to one. So each series is got its own posterior model probabilities. You can see, so for example, there's some preference here for the constant variance. Here it's more model weight on the stochastic volatility. And within both of these, the random variance shift models, the sort of change point models, show up having the largest weights. And so these are simulations from the posterior model dense. Kind of like the model fits from the posterior distributions of the parameters. So the red is the sort of median, and then it sort of goes out to the yellow and the white, which is sort of in the lower percentiles of the distribution. So you can sort of see the structure. Okay, this is a constant variance easily. This is sort of the, you can see the shifts in the variance structures coming down, becoming more narrow, And this is sort of the SV type, where it's more an AR1 process in the variance. And then I can overlay the data, so you can sort of see how well it fits on the model average. And then I did the same for the immigration and the emigration. So in the immigration, you sort of a lot of evidence for the random variance shift models. This is kind of split. This is more on the RV models, and this is more on the constant variance models. And then for the emigration, all are random variance shift models, essentially. So on the top here, I've got the immigration, on the bottom, the emigration. So you can here see this is a constant variance model, this is a random variance shift model. And then overlay the data. So you can see they're sort of fitting quite well to the data, the different series and adapting, and even in the sort of shorter periods, well, even more recent periods, you can see sort of the volatility is expanding in Norway for the emigration, for example. And these are the volatility processes. So this is sort of one thing that I was trying to get out of it to show that volatility isn't constant. It's worthwhile to have a non-constant variance when you use a time series model to forecast population migration. So here you can see, well, this is a constant variance model, but this is sort of your SV model. These are your variance shift models. And all of them, pretty much the volatility is coming down, but you can see even in later years, there's some sort of changes going on in the random variance shift models to show that it's, even the last 20, 30 years, it's not stable. Some general remarks. So most series are volatile, including those with only post-war data. So I was able to sort of identify parameters that would, for say this quite short series. Though I was worried that I wouldn't have enough data to do that, but it seemed to be the parameters identified. Even these long series have changing levels in volatility in recent decades. Like I said, they all tend to be downwards. As I mentioned, that might partly be due to these better measurements. So then maybe there's a lot more variance earlier on because of the way the data is measured. It tends to be that these random variance models do a bit better than the SV. Right? More of the processes are choosing random variance shift models. Proof was in the pudding. I did some forecasts by truncating the data. So I took the data going way back for the net series and stopped it in 1980, did a 10-year ahead forecast. Then I did it again at 1990, took all the data up to 1990 and did a forecast, and here at 2000. So you can see these are three sets of forecasts that I've done and how the data sort of fits. So these fans are based on the model averaged forecasts. And so you can see in some there, I mean, perhaps it's too narrow for this recent net migration into Norway. These are all the nets. These are all the immigration, and these are all the emigration. I had a condition that I would only do it if I had 50 data points. So here I didn't have enough data points to fit all the models. So I didn't produce a truncated sample here, truncated forecast. So I was quite happy with these because, for example, say immigration into Sweden, the fan looks really big, and if you show that to a policymaker, they are probably say that's way too big. But then when you look at how it's done in before, it's going even into up into the 85th percentile of the forecasted distribution. So it's not actually too unreasonable. So I mean, there's a few cases where perhaps it's too narrow here and here, like I mentioned. But overall, I was quite happy the way the random variance shift models performed and or how the whole model space performed. So some general remarks that the model average forecast provided did a reasonable job, and that's all. Well, I think it's easier to see it from the fans here than I had some empirical sort of numbers of data points that lie within the 80th percentile and so on, but the fans sort of show it a bit better. The random variance shift models were chosen sometimes. Sometimes they were too narrow. However, so I'll show you next that if I dropped the random variance shift models, just left it up to the constant variance and the stochastic volatility models, then things were really impractical. So this is just without the random variance shift models. So I recalculated the posterior model probabilities.
You could ask a question.
Yep.
I see, for example, for Norway, it's too narrow. If you start in the year 2000.
I'll go back to, oh, geez.
Can one expect that the immigration pattern is the same in the last decade as it was before year 2000?
No, because things change. But I mean, that's always a difficult way with migration. There's always going to be a policy change in the future that you could do. So, I mean, that sort of drives the motivation for expert opinion and bringing that in. I mean, they can foresee that. Or, for example, in Norway, that they know oil's going to run out. So
yeah, because your forecast is always in the upper range of your fan.
Yeah. And I kind of think that's, that's true, that it goes out of the upper range. And it's very difficult to get anything too well calibrated. I mean, maybe there's a better model out there that could do it, for sure. This was dropping the random variance shift model. So this is just model averaging over the constant variance and the stochastic volatility. So you can see for Norway, it's the fans are very big then. There's a lot of uncertainty. And so that's a lot more difficult to sell that sort of forecast to a policymaker. To show massive fans and then always end up sort of within the 60th or 40th percentile. And then this was sort of just with the constant variance. So this is sort of what people have pretty much done before when they fitted time series models, and perhaps why they don't use them too much, because without any sort of adaption for changing variance, then things get really wide. So, I mean, one thing that some people might do is cut the data short somewhere, say, oh, we only use post-war data. Then you have to think about where do I actually cut that data? It becomes a lot more awkward and messy. Whereas with the volatility models, you don't have that problem. So just a summary then on this sort of first half, that the model average results suggested having a time-varying variance sort of models were quite well calibrated. Even when it's controlled for, there's some sort of evidence that models with longer than one lag exist. So that's quite a bit of a finding that sort of demographers, if we do use a time series model, we just tend to use an AR1 or a random walk or random walk with drift. I never usually look at an AR2, but some of these were having quite high posterior model probabilities on AR2 and AR3. The random variance shift models do a reasonable job and on providing some sort of realistic uncertainty levels without being too large, whereas if I had the constant variance in the SV models, things became large. So then just, well, this is how I did everything in bugs. Create the models for bugs using this TS bugs package. So you could just write, I want a random variance shift model with AR2 in the mean and this prior, and it will create the bug script for you. So you don't have to bother going into bugs at all. You can then run bugs from R. And then I wrote a package for this bridge sampler, TS bridge, to take these time series models and then calculate the normalizing constant to get out the posterior model probabilities in the fans I did in the fan plot package. So that's about it on the migration. I just spent a little bit of time talking about the fertility problem as it is, or the fertility data. So kind of idea and motivation is to forecast fertility for all countries. We do this in Vienna. We produce global population forecasts for all countries. And ours are sort of very heavy on expert opinion. So it's sort of in competition a little with the UN that they produce their forecasts and they have different sets of expert opinion, essentially. It's the big difference. So fertility is really sort of one of the largest drivers of demographic change. And so the fertility forecast drives a lot of the global population estimates, and these global population forecasts are used all over climate change models and so forth. Even some many countries in Africa, they don't do any demographic forecasts themselves, so they would just take the UN or our projections that we have in Vienna and use them as basis for policy. The UN produces their demographic forecasts every 2 years, up to 2100 at the moment. So every 2 years they sort of revise the methodology, revise the base data, and produce their forecasts. Then recently they began to incorporate probabilistic methods. So before sort of Adrian Rafferty came along, they were using sort of high-low and stuff and without any measure of uncertainty on it. So I'm just going to talk about the fertility model. Rafferty's sort of also got a model for the mortality, and met him a couple of months ago in Rome, and he was doing migration as well. So he's doing the whole model in the end, all three components, but just concentrate on the fertility. So this is sort of how their model works. For any country, most countries, well, pretty much all countries follow this demographic transition, which sort of demographers see as you sort of have three phases. One is sort of TFR, sorry, is the total fertility rate. So it's the average number of women per children. So before sort of traditional societies, agricultural societies, developing countries, they sort of things fluctuate around 6, 7, 8 children per woman. Many of the children sort of don't make it beyond 5 years old or into a reproductive age. So women have a lot more children. Then things start to change, countries start to develop, women get more educated, they have less women. So they have less children, so infertility rates start to fall for a whole number of factors. It's very, very well studied on why fertility falls and where it falls. Sort of contraception use as well. And then it gets to a phase where countries become developed and it fluctuates. Well, some say around 2, but in some European countries it's sort of gone down, then it's gone back up again a little bit. That's a little bit of a kick. That things go up and then fluctuate around, between 1 and 3, essentially. So many European countries has been going on for quite a while. So the UN sort of defined these phases in a deterministic manner. There's no change point model there. And so the phase will start phase 2, they're not too worried about. They just say it's within a maximum. I don't quite understand this, and they don't really define it mathematically. They just say it's within 0.5 of the global maximum. The start of the phase 3 also, they do define mathematically. So here they say that the fertility in country C at time T has to increase and has to have 2 consecutive increases. And those consecutive increases have to be below 2. So you go back here, then it's sort of like you've got one increase and two increase. I think this graph is wrong, but this is the one they give in the paper. But I've written to the author saying that line should be there because it needs to be two increases below two, and then that should be the start of the phase. So, well, I and I think some other fertility experts that I work with, we sort of have a problem with this because it seems here you're already in a low fertility state. The transition's finished, and so things happen here. There's another problem with this model as well, that this might be the case for a European country, but for sort of East Asia countries that have low fertility, they don't really see this kick back up that European countries have seen. So I'll show you an example of that. Oh well, first I'll show you how they model the decline. So they have a separate model, one for the phase two and one for phase three. So for the decline phase, they have this, the fertility is equal in next year, next period is equal to this period minus the decline plus an error. And the decline is essentially two logistic curves put together. I'll just go forward and show you how that works. So this is, well, it's five parameters. D controls the height. These deltas control these different parts of the curves. And this is sort of the decrease, the drop in the fertility. So usually the drop comes fast and it slows down, then it sort of slows down here. So you can see for India, sort of, these are the observed data points and they fitted a curve to it. Mozambique and Zimbabwe, and it adapts quite well to all these different shapes of the falls in the fertility rates. And then, so they have that for the very complicated model for the decline. For the post-decline, they have just a simple AR1. I should say all the priors here. This is all done Bayesian hierarchical model where, sharing information across countries for each of these parameters, the priors are sort of hierarchical. And then, in the phase three, they have a simple sort of hierarchical AR1 model where mu and phi are sort of priors are based on the global, and then you can have some sort of like random effect effectively in a random slope. So I'll show you how these phase two works. So this is sort of their classic example that they like to give. So these are the observed points for Burkina Faso. These are the sort of fitted curve for Burkina Faso. These are phase one data, so that's before the decline. So they don't consider them because of course, they have a different variance, different structure, different things going on. And so the idea is that we'll continue along this trajectory for the future. So that's the median, and then these are the gray lines are like just random simulations from the MCMC.
Do you have an issue of trying to average curves which are not exactly well aligned in terms of their peaks? Is this an issue?
Well, that's sort of, they borrow strength from other countries to see the, so this is sort of like based on the, looks
this
at other.
What strikes me is that each of the individual curves is pretty smooth, but your median is of course not smooth, almost by definition of the median.
Yeah.
Is there a better way of choosing the average curve out of, so median is an average, but you take the median at each time point and then you put it together to create a median curve. By one day, there's a better measure of having an average curve among your curves and choosing that as your median.
There might well be. But.
Which goes into functional data analysis, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. This is not my work, so I want to say this is
right.
All
right.
This is all work from Rafferty
okay,
well, from
so
these papers. So I'm just presenting this to show the problem really of setting these phases and trying to think of different ways to define these phases. I've even found that this whole model is way too complicated. I mean, you can model this decline. You don't need a big decline curve and all these parameters and a big hierarchical Bayesian model that takes weeks to run. You could just have the lag and fit it in some type of multi-level model. I've done that and it seems to forecast just as well. So, I mean, another problem here, right? That's Burkina Faso, so that looks fine. Here's Singapore. Here you have your phase two data. So these are not all inside. These are phase three data, so they're in the AR1 part of the model. but it doesn't fit very well for these for developed countries that have seen rapid falls in fertility. And it also doesn't fit well for developed countries. This is France, so you see they have a lot of observations outside the sort of posterior distribution of the phase two model. So all these black points should ideally be somewhere in here, but they're not. And Hungary, again, hardly anything's in there. These are the projections based off these four countries that I showed. So for Burkina Faso, you can see it follows the decline curve. That's the future. Maybe these kinks, as we saw in the decline curve. And then perhaps towards the end, it's hitting phase three and switching into the AR1 model. Singapore, like I said, it's sort of rapid fall in fertility. It didn't see the kick back up that we have in the European country. And so, it switches in and it sort of goes back to the global sort of average for the phase three model. France, I think, show there's two data points in the phase three part of the model. But I think fertility experts might argue that the whole way through it's finished its transition. But because they have some really strict rules on how they define their change point to change into the phase three model, only two of these data points are considered not in decline. You see the scale here is different. It's only up to 2.5. So they only use two of these points to generate the rest of the forecast in. And the same with Hungary. Hungary is still considered as being in fertility decline, but many fertility experts would argue it's post decline for the whole of this series. All this data I think should be considered in the phase three part of the model in the post decline, help estimate the parameters there, help the forecast. But instead, they're all used to. They're all defined as being in this decline phase of the series, so they're helping estimate parameters in the decline model. That's really the problem, I guess. So every country is either in decline or post decline, and a large majority of the global population is going to either it's in this phase three part of the model, or it's going to be very soon, even by their strict rules. So China's there. China's next data point will be part of phase three. India will be there within a few projections. So this is pretty much a third of the world sort of thing. And so all their future population that's really dependent on the fertility model is based on, I think it's about 50 data points that they've got in the phase three of the model. So they use a lot of the data in the transition part of the model. I think that's really something to look into or a challenge for change point specialist. I've found this simple model for the fertility decline performs nearly as well as that decline curve that I was just mentioning. So I just lagged, I just regressed essentially the fertility with the lag of the fertility and the square of the lag of the fertility, and it did pretty much just as well. So the sort of idea is to try and find a model that identifies change points. I know that it's maximum two, but there's only 12 observations per country. So you go from each of these points are sort of 5-year averages. So the first one is for between 50 and 55, and it's from 55 to 60 and so on. So very short series, sort of in this panel data. I strongly suspect that if you can identify more post-decline observations more accurately. I mean, fertility guys in my office sort of say, well, Hungary is declined. So these observations should all be in a different part of the model. Then it's likely to produce more realistic, more accurate forecasts. And that's it. It's the same argument as migration as well. You have to forecast these things 100 years ahead. So then if you involve GDP in your model, you're going to need a explanatory variable GDP in 2100, which nobody does. So they don't worry about that.
And
do you include something for whether it's a religious country? So if it's a Christian country, presumably they might have higher fertility.
No, there's nothing, nothing like that. I mean, this is the model, right? So that they have. So, I mean, these all F is fertility, and these are all just parts of the fertility decline. These deltas. So, there's nothing on religion or education, and I mean, it's very difficult when you're trying to do all countries to have a database that has fertility by religion or fertility by education. It's a massive project to do that. In Vienna, we're trying to build a database on fertility by education, but the data just isn't there. It's difficult for the UN to even come up with numbers of fertility for, say, Burkina Faso. All they have is sort of sporadic censuses, demographic and household surveys, but they also have some sort of uncertainty with them. So the data that goes in has, especially for many African and some Asian countries, are uncertain themselves.
And for the migration stuff, how much of the migration from Norway comes from Finland?
Yeah, that's a lot. So, that's an idea for future work, but perhaps extending this to sort of multivariate VARs to have either immigration going together or immigration and emigration from other countries. But I think some countries, it's different for each country. Like, I think Norway is a bit more open. I mean, they took in a lot of Kosovans and, different nationalities, right, from former Yugoslavian. And whereas Finland, I don't think it's the same.
Sweden,
yeah, sorry, I get confused, yeah. And, Denmark's quite open as well, but then Finland isn't so much. Yeah. I think in Norway, they're doing... interesting project in their national statistics office where they sort of have this idea that they know the oil is going to run out, so they're trying to build in GDP into their forecast there. Then again, they're constrained. They can only go so many years ahead with this expected GDP under the model of the that their oil is going to sort of decline.
Yeah.